Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I'll be reading articles published by the Society in April of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. The first article is a guide to Sao Paulo, the Brazilian city defined by its creative subcultures. In Brazil's largest city and ever-evolving metropolis of intertwined cultures, diasporas from across the globe use music, art, and dance to make their mark. It's by Ellen Nimmelfarb. I'm still two blocks away when I hear the samba beat, subverted by a deep, assertive bass. At the far end of a pedestrian lane, paved in white tiles, a Beaux Arts villa called Casa de Francisca glows red and purple from within. Its tall second-story windows are flung open to reveal hundreds of partygoers. Behind the villa, there's Sao Paulo's historic center, the silhouetted at night. Once home to a musical instrument shop, then a radio broadcaster, before becoming an empty shell, the building now has more people inside than it's ever hosted before. When I enter, it feels as though they're testing the structural integrity of its Corinthian pillars. A fusion of black, white, mixed, indigenous, macho, and gender-fluid people, the crowd bounce and shout out lyrics, white shirts billowing, trilbies toppling. Their eyes are on the DJ booth, where Angola-born writer-musician Calaf Epelanja is spinning kazamba, a sweeping genre embracing Afrobeats, Portuguese pop, fervent hip-hop, and plaintive soul. When Calaf eases into a slower tempo, couples pair off in sweaty synchronicity or make out under the tiered chandelier. Two tall mirrors on the stage reflect the scene back to me. Emerging from Angolan clubs in southwestern Africa during the war-torn 1980s, kizomba culture has rippled through the Afro-Portuguese diaspora like waves across the Atlantic. It's difficult to define because it's considered an attitude, a matrix of Latin rhythms, new wave synthesizers, and early techno, but also fashion bravado and survival spirit that's found a footing in Sao Paulo. The Afropop Cape Verdean crooner, Djoji, is kazamba. So too is the Rio-based Afrobeats DJ Joss D. The literal meaning of kazamba in the Kambudu language, one of several spoken in Angola, is party. In this city of around 12 million, the world's largest Portuguese-speaking center, and Brazil's most populated city by a country mile, Calaf has a huge fan base. And this celebration of kazamba, led in partnership with Calaf's fellow artist, friend, and countryman, Nastio Mosquito, is their way of testing the waters for a permanent kazamba design museum in the city, with Casa de Francisca one possible home for it. The pair are clearly on to something. After his set, we sit down together, and Calaf puts it to me like this. The African diaspora in the Western world take whatever jobs are available from the bottom of the pyramid, he drawls. They're immigrants, invisible all week long. No one knows their story, but come Friday, they'll get their best outfits from the dry cleaner, call the barber, take pride in their presentation. That's why we call it kazamba design. Nastasio, his afro wilder than Calaf's and prematurely gray, says it's quite the opposite to fado, a Portuguese music genre of melancholic songs and rhythms that originated in the 19th century. Fado was all longing and pain. Kazamba celebrates, It shows there's a different way to live under stress. It says, we have today. So let's dance, let's drink, let's F blank blank K. The following morning, I see them both, about 20 minutes away from Megafauna, a sunlit bookshop where they're hosting a standing room only Kazamba symposium. The books, stacked to the ceiling, represent a diverse range of authors that reflect Sao Paulo's true mosaic. From the 16th century until 1888, horrifyingly late for abolition, Brazil took on more enslaved people from Africa than any New World country. And since the post-war industrial boom, many of their descendants have ended up in Sao Paulo. More than half of all Brazilians are black or mixed race, yet they still largely live on the margins. A lot of Brazilians are disconnected to their roots, Nastio tells me, but they're gaining agency. Megafauna sits on the ground floor of the rambling Edificio Copan, a 38-story S-shaped tower built in striking ribbed concrete by the late great Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer in the 1960s. There's an art gallery upstairs, a cafe next door chiseled out of a raw concrete shell, a vintage boutique, and 1,160 apartments in the floors above. The artists have chosen this landmark to lure their audience from the four corners of town. It's important that our culture can access places like this, says Nastio. This quarter of the historic center has suffered its share of neglect, though Sao Paulo's crime rate is lower than that of more touristy Rio de Janeiro. Calif admits this is not a city to play with. He tells me to be vigilant and to hide my phone in the streets from thieves on bikes. Still, he loves the Kazamba vibe around Edificio Copan. Sao Paulo doesn't have the beautiful nature of Rio. It's rough around the edges, so people only have each other and the culture to embrace. Calif isn't just referring to Africans like himself, but the whole spectrum of people taking over the pavement outside Edificio Copan. The immigrant influence defines the fabric of the city. It quickly gives you a glimpse of what Brazil represents, he says. I have the same feeling in New York, this big Babylon with people from all over the world. Topical and tropical. I see what he means over lunch at Z Deli, a leather booth diner in a mid-century building near Edificio Copan. Z is run by one of the 20,000 Jewish families who sought asylum in Sao Paulo over the 20th century. A 10-minute walk away is the Jewish Museum, a former Byzantine-style synagogue opened in 2021 to exhibit Brazilian Jewish artifacts. Similarly, Z's menu showcases a distinct hybrid flavor that straddles continents. I order what I think is a pastrami sandwich. What I get is shredded meat and spring onions on a bed of fries with a dollop of mayo, a jar of hot sauce, and a local Guarana brand ginger soda. Brazilian and Jewish cultures would seem to have little in common besides fate. And yet, simmering in Sao Paulo, they come together with fascinating synergy. Just east of downtown, past an awkwardly placed motorway, is Liberdade, spiritual home to hundreds of thousands of Japanese Paulistanos, the largest community off Japanese soil. I head there with Ferdinand Fillette, a tall, tanned tour guide, who leads me beneath red lampposts shaped like paper lanterns. Liberdade's tight knot of streets can't contain the crush of pedestrians buying Hello Kitty-themed pastels or dumplings and Amazonian fish yakitori, so vendors spill out onto a viaduct. Looking down at the traffic below, Fernando shares a description from the late Anthony Bourdain, who visited while filming his shows no reservations, and the layover. He said Sao Paulo feels like L.A. threw up on New York. Fernando quotes this to all his clients because Bourdain, who loved the city, had a point. You don't tend to hear bossa nova peons about the crisscrossing highway and graffiti-scrawled streets sprawling out from Liberdade. They're functional, but fun, smelling of Italian trattorias and Lebanese falafel huts. Then, as we approach broad, busy Avenida Paulista, they smarten up, flanked by audaciously designed brutalist towers. Avenida Paulista has a retro character, an unconventional beauty that appeals to me. Fernando points out a cool 1970s building by star architect Paulo Mendes de la Rocha, which flares out over the pavement like a bell-bottom. But I prefer the streets Sao Paulo Museum of Art, or MASP, a giant glass box hoisted in the air by stout concrete legs, painted a shouty shade of red. When its architect, Lina Bo Bardi, immigrated to Brazil from Italy in the late 1940s, she imported Italian modernism and the notion of public gathering spaces. She was a woman of the people, says Fernando. On the piazza, framed by MASP's red legs, the community spirit is palpable, filled with skateboarders toting boom boxes and families on promenade. Fernando urges me up to the vast glass gallery overhead, where paintings by globally renowned artists such as Modigliani and Picasso sit alongside emerging Brazilian ones, their works encased in glass and planted in concrete foundations. From here we can peer out of the glass walls and watch the late afternoon sun meet the skyline. I could spend a week basking in grand gesture museums like MASP, but I promised my new Kazamba mates I'd check out the scene in Barra Funda, north of downtown. On sunny morning, I meander among its charming painted stucco terraces. There's an antique shop under a deep awning and a bakery selling Portuguese custard tarts. An electric green Marataca parrot wolf whistles from the shoulder of an old man as I duck into HOA Galleria. Brazil's first black-owned art gallery, HOA, is hell-bent on shifting the narrative of Latin America art from the colonial to the personal, experiential, and revolutionary. Inside, it's somehow brighter than outside, all blazing brushstrokes and thrumming video. The same goes for Mendez Wood around the corner, a gallery where endless vaulted rooms grab you and keep you wrapped with installations exploring blackness and otherness by brilliant artists finally getting a platform. In fact, there's a gallery every 500 meters, and judging by the cocktail of languages I overhear, visitors have come from everywhere to appreciate them. COVID had an unexpected positive impact on this neighborhood, once known for Korean immigrants and industry. Home life pivoted to the pavements, and when the city opened up again, restaurants, bars, and galleries moved into the area's once empty warehouses. People took notice. Just off Rua Barra Funda, I watched the young, beautiful, and tattooed file into Mezcal, a cafe with communal tables, and a Bolivian chef experimenting with Cuban, Andean, and Mediterranean cooking. In an area spoiled for wine bars, everyone lines their stomachs here. That evening, it's back to Casa di Francesca to watch rapper Dino de Santiago, a Portuguese artist of Cape Verdean descent, fire up the crowd with absolute arm-swinging rapture. I can't help but get up out of my vintage cinema seat. We're rocking the place, Nastio says, when I can hear again. The crowd snaps into perfect sync for the electric slide line dance. They know every move, every word. Caliph says that's not surprising. All these people have the same cultural touchstones and they don't experience their stars playing in town. I ask him about those two big mirrors flanking the stage. He tells me that self-reflection is part of the design, emblematic of Kazamba. This culture is fragile, he says. Our traditions are ephemeral, oral. Our story is nowhere, but when we look at ourselves and we look at each other, we can see it. And that ends the article, the title, A Guide to Sao Paulo, The Brazilian City Defined by Its Creative Subcultures, by Ellen Himmelfarb. The title of our next article is Volcanoes Blow Smoke Rings, Here's How They Do It, by Robin George Andrews. Volcanoes are famed for their furious fireworks, from thundering pyroclastic flows to scorching rivers of lava. They can, however, be just as awe-inspiring during their quieter moments, like when a simmering peak blows a lazy smoke ring into the sky. Over the last few days, Italy's vertiginous Mount Etna has been doing just that, exhaling myriad ephemeral hoops up into the azure. Naturally, everyone who has witnessed this party trick wants answers. How on earth are volcanoes crafting smoke rings, and why are only some of these angry mountains capable of making them? Such apparitions have long been spotted flitting above multiple volcanoes across the world, but it wasn't always clear how they were being made. Although they can be hundreds of feet across, the rings are short-lived and unpredictable, making them difficult to study. But in 2019, a team of scientists led by Fabio Pulverinti, then a senior fellow at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and now at Henan Polytechnic University in China, decided to do the next best thing and simulate them on a computer. Their results, published in the journal Scientific Reports in 2023, reveal that these smoke rings are made much in the same way that cigarette smokers blow rings, and how smoke cannon toys eject fog through a narrow circular opening. With all three, there needs to be a substantial amount of vapor collected and then expelled quickly to form a decent ring. It certainly looks impressive, but in the end, it all comes down to some pretty straightforward physics. What is a volcanic smoke ring? Despite the name, volcano smoke rings aren't made of smoke, explains Boris Beckney, a volcanologist at Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, who was not involved with the 2019 research. Instead, the volcanic variants are largely made up of condensed gases, predominantly water vapor, escaping from the magma and propelled from the volcano's vent. Strong winds can prevent rings from forming, but in their absence, gossamer circlets forged from a decent supply of volcanic vapor, which is warmer and less dense than the surrounding air, can drift toward the sky and start expanding. Eventually, when they shed most of their vapor, the rings vanish from sight. But only some volcanoes seem to be able to make smoke rings, and only at certain times. Back when Pulverinti first learned about them in 2013, he found that the scientific literature offered no substantive answers. But when his curiosity became too much to bear, he recruited some colleagues and took a crack at solving the mystery. The team perused plenty of observations of volcanic smoke rings, seeing how high they rose, how fast they moved, how quickly they cooled, how much their compositions varied, and how frequently they contained ash. The scientists also read up on how magmatic gases migrated through and escaped from volcanic conduits, and they dove into the complex physics of vortex formation in fluids, gleaned from laboratory experiments. They then plugged all their findings into a computer model by fiddling with the buildup of pressure within the conduit, as well as the geometry of the virtual volcano's vent, the team worked out just what it takes to make smoke rings. How do smoke rings form, and why don't all volcanoes do it? As magma rises through the conduit, the surrounding pressure drops, allowing dissolved gases to emerge as bubbles. If the magma is not too viscous, bubbles can merge into singular pockets of pressurized gas. When they approach the vent, these gas pockets can violently depressurize and explode, propelling hot vapor forward, upward, sometimes at near supersonic speeds. Vapor ejected from the vent then drags on the volcano's rocky sides, causing the ball of gas to roll up around the edges. Then, as the rolled-up vapor ring meets the cold atmosphere, it chills, decelerates, condenses, and becomes visible, a bit like the contrails of airplanes. Crucially, to make rings, a volcano's vent must be fairly circular, and the sides of the vents have to be the same heights. If the vent is too irregularly shaped or broken up, the ring may be severely warped, unstable, or won't form at all. Benjamin Simons, a volcanologist at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, back when Pulvirenti presented his team's results in 2019, has seen smoke rings at several persistently active volcanoes, including Mount Yasar in Vinitu. Most of the rings he saw escaped from skylights, roughly circular natural openings perched above the level of volcanic vents that are open to the beautiful night glow of magma below, he says. When small puffs of volcanic gas are forced through these narrow openings, smoke rings appeared. They rose ponderously, he explains, rarely having the power to leave the summit crater before fading away. The results of Pulvinetti's computer model match with Simon's own observations. The more circular the opening, the more likely it is to produce a smoke ring, he says. Pulvirenti's model explains why smoke rings aren't seen at every volcano all the time, since the rings require such precise conditions to form. Even when those conditions are met, however, smoke rings don't always appear, suggesting that there is more to the gassy pandemonium within volcanoes than we currently know. That completes the article. The title was Volcanoes Blow Smoke Rings. Here's How They Do It, by Robin George Andrews. Our last article is titled, Is Sleeping on Your Stomach or Back Better? Here are some bedtime myths debunked, by Aaron Blakemore. How did you sleep last night? If you're like most people, you assumed your favorite position at bedtime. But once sleep sets in, you likely moved again and again, shifting into multiple positions as you slept. If you wonder whether there's an ideal way to sleep, you're not alone. There's plenty of conflicting advice and dubious online information linking sleep positions to various benefits or problems, and the market is flooded with devices that promise to keep you from sleeping on your back, the scapegoat of most sleep position sciences. But it turns out we have way less control over how we sleep than we might think, and we might be better off not trying. Debunking early sleep theories. Are you a flamingo, a Dutch wife, or a royal? The question isn't part of a party game, though it might sound like it. These colorful monikers are used to describe the seemingly limitless way in which our bodies arrange themselves while sleeping. They're just a selection of the terms coined by psychologist Samuel Dunkel, who penned a popular psychology book in 1977 calling sleep positions the night language of the body. For Dunkel, sleep positions gave clues about an individual's personality traits and psychology. Their bodily positions during the most vulnerable hours of offering hints of how they move through the waking world. This analysis prompted a young Joseph de Koninck, a psychologist in Canada, to wonder how people really sleep at night. He created a stop-motion method for photographing sleep positions throughout the night without waking a patient. But the psychologist, now an emeritus professor at the University of Ottawa, soon concluded that a person's position during sleep has nothing to do with their personality, preference, or even sleep stage. So what does science tell us about our sleeping position? Dr. Koenig's research has showed that the number of times people change positions during sleep goes down with age, and that older adults strongly prefer sleeping on their right side, a position that could help regulate blood pressure. Meanwhile, other studies show that people tend to spend half of their sleep time on their sides, with older and obese patients moving less than their younger counterparts. After dozens of studies on the topic, de Koenig is now convinced that sleeping position is more a reflection of anatomy and physiology than a person's psychology, and that once you go to sleep, your body's in charge of its position. Malhotra agrees. There are definitely positions that are more comfortable for certain patients, he says. For example, an injury in your left leg or shoulder might prompt you to sleep mostly on your right side. Controlling someone's position at nighttime is very difficult, he says. The majority of patients who need to change their sleep position are back sleepers experiencing sleep apnea, in which the airway collapses or does not function properly, causing a person to stop breathing multiple times per night. Some people turn to fancy sleep training devices to keep them off their backs. Though only a few are FDA approved, these devices buzz, inflate, and poke patients into different sleep positions. Meanwhile, others simply tape a tennis ball to their back to make back sleeping uncomfortable, an old school method that has actually been shown to work, as well as special sleep training devices. Still, training someone to adopt a different default sleep position can take months, and setbacks are common. Studies show that patients tend to abandon both tennis balls and other devices because of the discomfort they cause. And with that, we have run out of time today. The title of this article was, Is Sleeping on Your Stomach or Back Better? Here are some bedtime myths debunked by Aaron Blakemore. This has been the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader today. Hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program, go to sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on demand. Hopefully you'll find your article in the listing. Thank you very much for spending your time with me today.